From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Rick Pantaleo, broadcaster and producer with VOA's Current Affairs Desk. Rick is the author of the popular Science World blog and host of the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. On this year-end edition of the program, we welcome Amy Webb, author, futurist, and founder of Future Today Institute, for our annual conversation about the future of technology and its implications for business, society, and politics. The Future Today Institute is a leading future forecasting firm now in its second decade. Founded by Amy Webb in 2006, the Future Today Institute focuses exclusively on how emerging technology in science will disrupt business, transform the workforce, and ignite geopolitical change. It uses data-driven research to model and prototype the future. Amy is the author of several books, the most recent of which, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream, which explains how to predict and manage technological change. She has also published many articles relating to the future of technology in business. In addition, for over 15 years, Amy Webb has been dedicated to helping inform and shape the future of journalism. We'll talk with Amy about the latest trends in technology and how foreign adversaries or malicious actors have exploited social media sites like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram to post and disseminate false news and advertisements, and what can be done to curb this trend, which some argue threatens the integrity of our democracy. Amy Webb joins us by phone from her office at the Future Today Institute. Amy Webb, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Carol.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Rick Pantaleo, our very own in-house science and technology guru. Well, Amy, let's turn to you. What would you say are the most striking trends as we enter 2018?
I think that 2017 was a pretty tumultuous year. Part of that has to do with the intersection of widespread differences in worldview and thinking, which has always existed, with the confluence of different technologies which make it much faster, easier for us to express our viewpoints, and it also makes it easier to automate the expression of those viewpoints. So going into 2018, we'll probably see more, not less of that, but we'll also see the emergence of virtual assistants and mixed reality devices and even smart farms.
Smart farms.
Yep.
Explain.
Sure. So everybody's at this point no doubt heard about artificial intelligence or AI. AI feels new, but it's actually been in some form of development for over 150 years. Modern AI was really born in the 1960s, and we finally, in the years 2017 to 2019 and 2020, have enough compute power and enough components and enough people to help that ecosystem blossom. So when I mention AI, people tend to think about killer robots, or they think about movies that they've seen where there have been characters based in AI. But there are a lot of other day-to-day practical applications. For example, there are different companies now that are using artificial intelligence to create better seeds and better crops that are more resistant to huge changes in climate and extreme weather patterns, which we know all around the world are becoming more and more common. But we also have similar kinds of systems that can recognize food. So if you live in an area of the world where you're concerned about contamination or you're concerned about the quality and integrity of the ingredients, pretty soon we'll have much more transparency in helping us understand where those products came from, where the food came from, and we'll have farms that require less natural resources to produce better quantities. So theoretically, what that means is we have more produce available to more people around the world with better transparency about where that food came from.
Amy, speaking of AI, I don't know if you've heard the news recently. There was a discovery of a seventh exoplanet in a star system far away from us, and the seventh planet happened to be spotted with the help of machine learning, a Google application using machine learning that helped NASA find the exoplanet. Any thoughts about machine learning and its applications?
One of the originators of modern AI is named Mervyn Minsky, and he likened the term AI to a suitcase. He called it a suitcase word. And if you think about it, a suitcase is a thing that you can shove a bunch of other things into. And AI is very much like that. So machine learning is a part of this sort of next era of computing. And what we're able to now do is to train computer systems to do the work that we would do, but orders of magnitude faster, more efficiently, and more powerfully, so that these systems ultimately can glean more information out of the data than humans could alone. And searching the cosmos for planets and other life forms is one of the many, many, many applications of machine learning.
And following up with that, another aspect of AI is something called neural networks. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that means?
The best way to think about artificial intelligence is it's not a tech trend. So it is the next evolution of computing. Think of it as the next era of computing. Neural networks are the complex systems of computers and nodes and devices and code that powers that next era of computing. So these are complex systems that are named neural networks in part because they mimic how we think the brain works. With that being said, there's a lot we don't know about the brain. And again, like in the 1960s when Mervyn Minsky and his colleagues were all working on what is now the realization of AI as they imagined it in the 60s, one of the questions they asked was whether or not machines might someday achieve a sort of consciousness, or whether or not they would have to achieve consciousness and to think just like we do. And in order to learn, that they would have to process information and learn how to think just like we humans do.
I happen to read that your organization actually uses components of AI. How does FTI use artificial intelligence?
We don't predict the future. I'm a quantitative futurist. My job is to try to figure out what emerging technologies on the horizon and how those developments might impact us all in the future. So some of that is done through traditional research methods. But at some point, in order to take in as much information as possible, we also have to do some sophisticated pattern recognition, and that is done using some machine learning. On that always, but it depends on the topic that we're working on.
Well, Amy, let me turn back to Earth here for a second and talk about, you know, to what extent social media maybe threatens our democracy rather than enhances it. And that goes back to 2016 and 2015 and not long ago, and I'm paraphrasing from an article in The Economist, social media held out the promise of more enlightened politics, accurate information, effortless communication, speed of communication, helping good people drive out corruption, bigotry, and lies. We recall the so-called Arab Spring, and Facebook was used as a mobilization tool for people to get out into the streets to protest dictators and so forth. And yet, Facebook acknowledged that sometime between January 2015 and August of 2017, millions of users may have seen Russian disinformation on its platform. And Google's YouTube admitted that there were over 1,000 or so Russian-linked videos. Twitter, tens of thousands of accounts were fake. So far from bringing enlightenment, social media has in a sense been spreading fake news or poison. What do we do, and how do you see this phenomenon going forward, and how do we combat it?
I think it's good to do some level setting here. It is not as though Russia decided in the year 2015 to monkey around with the election in the United States or elections elsewhere in the world. The spread of misinformation through social networks predates our most recent election in the United States. And I had personal experience with this in a sort of surprising way. My sister, several years ago, posted something on Facebook. It was like a funny cat video. And we've all seen plenty of funny cat videos. This was a good one. This was a really funny cat video. However, I noticed that the logo for the source was a little green square with the letters RT in black. And I thought that was pretty curious. So I called my sister and I said, really funny video. where'd you find this thing? And she said, oh, she's been following this website, RT, which to her was like a ripoff of BuzzFeed. And their logo at the time was a little sort of orangey-red square with the letters BF in it. And my sister thought, well, RT must just be a ripoff of that, and they're also posting funny cat videos. And I said, would it surprise you to learn that that's Russia Today, which is a propaganda arm of the Russian government? And she was shocked. She was absolutely flabbergasted. And that is merely one of hundreds of millions of cases where people have sort of unwittingly been following and sharing and spreading information, not just from the Russian government, but from lots of different places all around the world. I think part of that has to do with the sophistication with which some of these groups have been creating their videos, and they've been good students of how viral content works. So I think part of it's that, but part of it is in the digital realm, our attention spans are shrinking by the micro minute. And as a result of that, we don't stop to investigate or even read where sometimes that content is coming from. That's what makes this problem, I think, so complicated, but also so deeply, deeply fascinating. It's not entirely Facebook's fault or Twitter's fault. It's not entirely our fault. And if we want the spread of misinformation to stop, we all have to do something about it. So the platforms have to wisen up. There's sort of a disincentive for them. The more salacious the content is, and a lot of studies have shown that the more negative the content is, the more likely it is to spread, which means more clicks, which means more dollars, right?
So exactly.
Facebook and Twitter are sort of disincentivized from policing the content. Everyday people have to slow down. And if they want less misinformation and disinformation going forward, and if we want to have a smarter global electorate, then we have to decide that we're going to slow down and stop for a moment and consider what it is that we see. And that has to do with digital literacy. And that also means that schools all around the world have to do a better job of teaching kids from a pretty early age how to distinguish between primary source information and trustworthy information and information that may not be trustworthy. But that's an all-out effort that involves every one of us, not just journalists, not just the platforms, not just governments. It's all of us together.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Amy Webb, founder and CEO of the Future Today Institute, a leading future forecasting firm. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Rick Pantaleo. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Mr. Monta Tanaka from Japan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now, back to our special guest, Amy Webb, and a question from my colleague Rick Pantaleo.
I want to follow up with your previous comments, Amy, addressing Carol's question about social media. And you mentioned something about that everyday people need to slow down and that our attention spans are shortening. Is this more of a cultural thing? In other words, something that's more prevalent in developed countries more so than developing countries?
When we think about what's coming next, when we think about the future, we often forget about the past. Whatever social condition any given generation is in, that generation assumes it's the first time it's ever happened. So you hear a lot about shortening attention spans and the speed at which we all live life now. But every previous generation all around the world said the exact same thing, because it's how we evolve alongside technology. Now, the question is whether or not that's true of developing nations. Here's what I would say to that. Given what we know to be true about mobile technology and the availability of mobile infrastructure and different networks, developing nations which may have sort of tenuous economies and infrastructure concerns, a lot of them still have access to mobile devices. A lot of the people living within these regions have access to mobile devices, and they may not have 5G connections, but they have pretty fast connection speeds, which allow for things like mobile banking and also allow for connections via all different types of social networks. And in fact, there are lots of places around the world where Facebook itself is now providing the internet infrastructure, enabling people to use their mobile devices to get online. We certainly, in the year 2018, will find ourselves at the beginning of this sort of process where life is going to continue to move faster. And the rate of change will seem to be moving with more velocity, I think, than it has in the recent past. And that has to do with the emergence of all these different technologies, our communication networks, the sort of next era of computing and how it will power so much of our everyday lives in ways that we won't see. I think life will feel pretty different over the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years.
Amy, I need to follow up on this social media and who's responsible for the proliferation of either fake news, fake accounts, or false ads. And something struck me when I heard it the other day on the radio. I heard that Facebook bans cannabis ads. And when I heard that, I said, that's odd. They ban ads for marijuana, some of which can be used for medicinal purposes. But it struck me that they allowed Russian trolls to promote fake accounts and even accepted rubles, we understand. So how do you square that? How do you reconcile the banning of cannabis ads, and yet they allowed these social media platforms a much more nefarious influence, that is, Russian trolls promoting fake accounts and advertisements?
Sure. Well, one is preventative and one is reactionary. So it's easy to write code that would disallow cannabis ads in advance. What's harder to do, although I would argue much more important, is to come up with scenarios for all the different ways that your network might be used, and then to sort of reverse engineer those scenarios back to the present day and to deal with them. The fact that Russia has used Facebook to spread misinformation should be absolutely no surprise to anybody in that organization. Twitter obviously has also been used in the same way. And I once heard one of the founders of Twitter, actually just a few months ago, say that they never thought that the network could be used in that way. It never occurred to them.
That's very naive.
Would be, pardon me?
That's so naive.
Well, it's one of three things, right? It's either completely naive, it's a lie, right?
That's right.
Or it's an acknowledgement that they chose to look a different way. And if it's the case that they're naive and Facebook is that naive, then you know I'm gravely concerned about our future. And I just don't think it's the case in either case.
No, I agree with you. It's a profit line, the profit margin that they want to make.
Yeah, now, to be fair, you can't come up with a scenario for everything. You can't even use AI to do that.
But what about human beings? I mean, having more real editors, you have to hire people with brains who can,
But the math doesn't work. There is no way to hire enough humans to edit or to even observe. The volume of posts is too great. There's no way that Facebook or Twitter or Weibo or any other social network could hire enough humans at this point to deal with the volume of content. Therefore, what you do is you write code to combat it. And I hear all the time that's just not possible, that there's no way to make that happen, and that's just not true. Without getting super technical, there are plenty of ways to solve the problem, but you have to want to solve the problem. And at the moment, there's a business case that sort of incentivizes against solving the problem.
Okay. Well, quickly, before I turn to my colleague, Rick, on the ad side, that's not the content side, which is also very problematic given fake accounts and false news. But in terms of advertising, the Congress has come up with some legislation called the Honest Ads Act, which would require that Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube be seen more as broadcast platforms and not the neutral platforms that they like to see themselves as. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they would be subject to the same disclosure requirements as broadcasters. How much of a difference do you think such legislation would make in reducing the proliferation of these false ads?
Very little. And I got to say, hearing you describe that just made me so angry. Here's why. Our government is so reluctant to take an objective, depoliticized look at emerging technology. In the United States, we no longer have the nonpartisan body of trained scientists and mathematicians and researchers whose job it is to model out scenarios for the future and advise and teach the people who write policy and vote so that they can make objective decisions when they are not under duress. That whole thing got defunded in the 90s. It doesn't exist anymore. It was called the Office of Technology Assessment. So what we're left with is a group of partisan lawmakers.
Well, this was a bipartisan legislation, Democrat and Republican.
I mean, I understand that there are probably folks from both sides of the aisle who have their names on it, but it's fighting a war that's already happened. And when you try to legislate something that happened in the past, all you wind up doing is creating an opportunity and a window for lobbyists and lawyers to come in and advocate for commercial purposes. And let's just stop for a moment. When you think about broadcast networks, you have a network, or let's say that you're CBS, right? And you have, 23 affiliate stations or whatever it might be in the United States, or you're the BBC. You can only have a certain number of advertisements run because you can only broadcast, 24 hours in a day. Therefore, there's an upper echelon of the number of ads that can be shown, and it's not that many. You could run an ad every microsecond, but those ads are completely tailored differently depending on the person who's looking at it. My point here is there is no way to enforce that. And this is a global problem. It's emblematic of a global problem where the legislatures and the lawmakers in all countries around the world have decided that maybe they should be trying to regulate or setting some kind of norms and standards. And as a result of that, we are winding up with an internet that is splintered, a series of splinter nets where the rules are different depending on which geographic boundaries you happen to be in when you're accessing the internet. So there are hundreds of pending cases of legislation all around the world. There are all these cases now pending against Facebook and against Google and other digital companies. And the problem is if we wind up with a series of splinter nets where the internet, the rules of the internet are different depending on what part of the country you're in or what part of the world that you're in, there is no way to enforce that. If you think that 2017 was a bad year for misinformation, you literally have no idea what's coming.
In the interest of time, and I do want to add that this Honest Ads Act was sponsored by a Democrat and a Republican, and it was done in the context of election-related online advertising that would be subject to the same disclosure and disclaimer requirements as similar ads in other media. But your answer, of course, is still that it wouldn't have much of an impact.
It's a reaction to something that's happened. That legislation assumes that the rules won't change going forward, or that behaviors won't change, or that the algorithms won't change. We cannot continue to have our lawmakers write legislation based on something that just happened when it has to do with science and technology. We are witnessing the same problems, not just with regards to social media, but with regards to autonomous vehicles and gene editing, CRISPR-Cas9 here in the United States. We are seeing this across the board, and it is because our lawmakers in the United States are uninformed, and because, unfortunately, science and technology has become politicized. But that's not just in the United States. We're seeing that all over the place, all over the world.
Let me turn to Rick for another question.
One of the trends that I've noticed over the past several years, and that's media consolidation. In other words, pushing control of media into fewer hands. And on a related issue, here in the United States, we've recently have an issue called net neutrality. Net neutrality laws put into place by former President Barack Obama. Those laws have been struck down. Many people take that as a way of a few internet providers basically controlling what the audience gets to see.
Well, yes and no. So now that net neutrality rules have been repealed, we're assuming that the major internet service providers in the United States will start to throttle and control access to consumers. Now, it should be said that, again, we are in this situation because our ISPs failed to map out the future. And unfortunately, it's the same story over again. So when the pipe was being laid, there was a sort of Wild West approach, and it was not from the get-go a government utility. And so over time, we have far more people, not fewer people, trying to access those networks, which means that the original model for scale, the original business model, doesn't really apply anymore. And over time, everybody thought that Americans would keep watching cable. In the United States, when you subscribe to television service, you kind of get a bundle of all different television channels. This is true of like Sky TV also in Europe. It's the same basic idea. Well, most people don't need or want all 300 of those channels, but bundling all of those channels together is how the business model worked out. It was meant to be an incentive. It was why people would agree to pay higher rates for their cable. Well, people are no longer tethered to their television screens because we've got plenty of content available through Netflix and through Hulu and lots of other online sources. Therefore, the business model doesn't work. And what's wound up happening is net neutrality is a reaction to the fact that the business models don't work anymore. It's to try to get people to continue subscribing as they always have. You know, and again, that may work for another couple of years, but at some point, even that goes away. So net neutrality has been kind of a confusing issue here in the United States. The rollback of the net neutrality laws basically just returns us to the status quo, but the status quo wasn't working. And even if the ISPs start to throttle individual customers or if they try to change the rates, again, how long does that stopgap measure actually play out? So again and again and again, it's impossible to predict exactly what the future will look like. It's impossible to predict exactly what the technology or the science will evolve into. But one thing that we do know is that change will always be coming, which tells us that every business, every government leader, and I would argue every human being, needs to be strategically thinking about the future and making better decisions in the present.
So you are not necessarily opposed to the repeal of these net neutrality rules?
No, I'm absolutely opposed to them. But to me, that argument is not a complete argument. I'm opposed to the repeal of the net neutrality rules. However, I'm more irritated at the fact that this doesn't actually solve any future problems that are coming.
Well, let's ask you as we close, Amy. You've been very articulate with regard to the great responsibility that we all have as individuals around the world in trying to distinguish truth from fiction on social media, and also in holding social media platforms responsible for what they host on their platforms and not let the bottom line dictate what goes up or algorithms just because a certain post gets lots of clicks. So what are your final words with respect to going forward, particularly with regard to social media? As we saw former President Barack Obama speaking with Prince Harry, warning about the corrosive nature of social media.
Well, it's not all corrosive. So there are plenty of instances and circumstances in which social media has corrupted, has been a corrosive element in democracies and in societies all around the world. But there are also equal number of examples where social media has led to democratic uprisings in a very positive way and has helped connect families in ways that otherwise they would not be able to be connected. I think it's part of the great pantheon of stories that we have told ever since the beginning of humanity, and that is the most wonderful things in life, the things that hold the most positive power, oftentimes have a dark side. And in every story that's ever been told, the only way to navigate through those extremes is to take more time as individuals to suss out the good from the bad, to have the discipline to walk away from something that's negative or corrosive, and to try to make best use of the positive force that we have. So with social media, I think it's the same. The truth is that if Facebook went away tomorrow, life wouldn't really be that much different. So what that tells us is we have the ability to walk away, and we also have the ability to think critically. We just have to engage and decide that that's what we want to do. 2017, I don't think, was an anomaly, and I keep hearing over and over from people how excited they are for the new year to begin. Just because the calendar changes over doesn't mean that our problems from 2017 go away. And I think everybody needs to think very, very carefully about the future that we're heading into, given that we haven't made very many changes in the present.
Indeed, and I think a few more courses on digital literacy for all of us would go a long way. Well, thank you very much, Amy, for taking time to speak with us. Amy Webb is the founder and CEO of Future Today Institute. As always, we greatly appreciate your terrific insights.
Thanks. It's always a fun conversation.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. And joining me on the program was Rick Pantaleo, host of Science Edition and author of Science World Blog. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week and next year for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.